Well, this is the bit you've all been waiting for. You've sat through an hour and 20 minutes of us talking to you and trying to explain what UK CP09 is all about. I hope, if nothing else, you've gathered it's big and it's very different from what we had before, which was UK CIP02. The opportunity is now here for you to ask some questions. I'm just waiting for my microphone wranglers to get themselves in position. So if you've got a question, please put your hand up and we'll take it from there.
Shall I read my name or just?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Mr. Stefano Bonfa. I'm involved in a sustainable issue. And I would like, of course, I need to use this information for the sustainability issue. My question is two. One is, it is possible to access to the set of records, because as I understand, you develop, in a way, application that we are using, the result of an application. If we want to go to the really granularity of data, it is possible to access. This is the first question. Second question is, how did you build the full, let's say, system, integrated system? Because we have, I think, it's not just localized in UK, but it is in Europe and global level. How, I mean, just to have a feeling of the model you build in any system. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I think in summary, and that was, how do you go about accessing the numbers behind what you've seen today, and how was the system all put together?
That sounds like a Roger question.
Thank you. All the data is accessible through the user interface. One of the options that is available to you is when they were going through the example there was to access the actual data that goes behind it. There are two types of data that are available. One is the data that is used to develop the maps or produce the maps, graphs, etc. And that is a particular type of data, and it's based, there's all characteristics of it that dictate how you can and how you cannot use that. And I won't go into that right now. That's about an hour's lecture. And the other set of data is sample data, which allows you to look at the because of its characteristics, is a greater amount of utility in terms of doing impacts assessments and adaptation assessments. So that they're right there. There's terabytes of that. And when you go in, you do it because of the reason we showed the figures, et cetera, is because it goes like that. It very quickly, it can be produced. And so we wouldn't be sitting here saying, okay, 15 minutes, and then we'll now see the results. So the data does take time to download because you're accessing terabytes of it. Now, building a full integrated system, I'm not too sure. I was trying to get an appreciation for your question. And the modeling is done. It starts out, the modeling is done at a global level, and the models are all run globally. And then there's the regional climate models put in, and the regional climate model downscales it to the 25 kilometers. And the modeling is run the regional climate model is run at a European scale. And the information is actually available on another website, all at a European scale. But only it is not probabilistic. It's a very limited, it's only 11 members. So it's only that's available somewhere else. The only place that this is done at a probabilistic level is for the UK and the 25-kilometer grid squares that you've seen there. There is, besides the modeling, there's a complete statistical analysis that goes in behind it using Bayesian statistics. And again, I don't want to get into that. I'll be here all day.
But there is something like 25 terabytes of data that you can interrogate using the user interface, if I'm correct.
Yeah, it's in that neighborhood, and don't try and download it. Use the user interface. if you try to download it, and you actually have the facilities to store it, I'd be very interested in that. But if you try to download it, your job will be priorized very, very low, and you might get it in a few years. Okay. Go grid square by grid square.
Yeah. The lady with the blonde hair.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Jane Fellows, and I'm from Warwick HRI, University of Warwick. We're funded by DEFRA, looking at impacts on UK agriculture. So I'm obviously a weather generator person. Can you just explain a about the 30-year time series and the sampling of the 100, minimum 100 to maximum 1,000 runs, because I haven't found that very clear on the website to actually distinguish. If we want to look at variation, say if we're modelling a pest and what's likely to happen, how should I be interpreting this?
Okay, I think, again, that's a question for Roger.
Absolutely.
But perhaps, Roger, you could start off by saying just a little bit more about the weather generator and how you should use the weather generator properly.
Yeah, the weather generator is, I've tried to explain this. A lot of people, when they saw it first coming out, says, what are we doing putting out 5-kilometer grid spatial resolution projections for the future on hourly and daily value timescales? We are not doing that. That's the first thing. The lowest that we felt even comfortable doing, and there is even some uncomfortable people at that scale, is the 25. What the weather generator does, it allows you to explore, at the scale that people are making decisions, plausible climates that would occur during a particular 30-year time period at a particular location. And what it does is a statistical tool, and it looks at and analyzes the current climate and develops these statistical relationships. And then what it does is it says, okay, take those and now change them by the amount that is projected by the 25-kilometer grids in that area. And so what you do then is you get a series, and it doesn't produce one climate. It reproduces, as the question was, it produces a minimum of 100, a maximum, I think it is, of 1,000 that it produces. And what you do is it explores the statistical nature of the climate at the daily level that could occur. And that's what you're getting. It's a statistical representation. If you want hourly, what it has to do is it disaggregates that based on some rules that were developed based on the previous, the observed climate, of how that would be disaggregated over a 12-hour or 24-hour period. So what you have is that with those, you have an option when you go in, is that it produces either 30 years, 100 times, so let's just go to the minimum, 100 time series, 30 years in length. But you can also do 100 time, representing that 30 years of climate, but you can also do a 100 time series of 100 years of that 30-year climate. So it's giving you a much more statistical representation of the information that is the possible climates that are in that period. And again, you use this as a means of trying to understand the nature of that climate, not the climate of July 15th, 2051, but you're trying to understand the climate that could be possible during that time. So you're using it to explore the potential impacts that could occur during that time. And it uses the sample data, and you can select various options. So this is why I said don't just look at a map, don't just look at something. What you do is that you want to focus on a particular period of time in your particular period of time. You may want to use the joint probability plots and focus on a particular. It's all explained in the user guidance. I know it's not a simple tool to use. It's not something you can just jump up and down and use just like that. I'm not answering your question. I can tell by your response.
Can I just say that we've already done 2 years studies using UK CIPO2 and the Long Ashton weather generator at Rothamsted?
Yes.
Could I just make a comment, actually, because I do understand that better now. So the 30 years or whatever is just a time series.
It's and the length of the time series.
And the 100 to 1,000 is different samplings of that. Could I just suggest that you perhaps put something else on the guidance, because I found that really hard to follow.
Very much so, and that, like
so
I said,
I hope you don't mind me making a suggestion.
Nope.
Yeah. But
that's what we're looking for in terms of on the user guidance. When you go into the weather generator, we've tried to provide some guidance, and again, it's without having people use it. So what we're trying to do is, can we be a little bit more clearer in some way? You can't often, we tried to link, and hopefully within a couple of days, the links will be much more operational, because a lot of the links had to be taken out because of the flat system. We tried to link between the user interface and the user guidance a lot more effectively, and that will help you do that as well.
Yeah, if I just ask the questioner, could you submit that through our help desk?
So
then we can capture that, and it will go through that central process and get flagged up to the team back in the office. That would be fantastic. Thank you. Who's next? Laurie, you've got a question up there, yeah.
Hello, Gabriel Hemery from the Silver Foundation. I operate a forestry think tank. I applaud you for what you've achieved, especially the probabilistic elements. It's maybe a simple question, but I was just interested in how this was perceived at the global level in terms of how we could, at a practical level, collaborate with scientists and so on internationally. You've obviously introduced quite a lot of new terminology, talk about central estimates rather than medians and so on. How is this plugging into the global sort of climate change community when we collaborate at that level?
Okay, Chris.
I think there are at least two other teams who are doing something similar in generating probabilistic information in Australia and in the States. And they've used different methods. There's clearly very many different methods we could use to bring in probabilistic information. We all have the same parallel problem that some people think they know how to deal with it, and a lot of people aren't at all sure. And we intend to talk to those other groups and actually find out a lot more. How do people use information like this? And perhaps further down the line, is there a best method of incorporating lots of modeling possibilities into a probabilistic output? At the moment, we're just at the start of this process.
One of the things with respect to the language is that we've been very conscious about using the language that is accepted within the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the community that, the climate change community. So we've been very careful about using that language because of the problem of introducing new language can can confuse people. So if you go in, you'll see the same language being used in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, like central estimate, very unlikely, those types of things.
And some of the other language that we've used, and certainly the central estimate, came really through our stakeholders when we did some initial workshops 18 months ago, and we started exploring the use of language with them. Just a follow-up from that. The scenarios that are used in UK CPO9 are IPCC SRES scenarios. Is there compatibility in any respect looking at the UK climate projections and other projections around the world?
Yeah, there is compatibility. One of the emission scenarios that has been used, I think it's the A1B, is one that every modeling community in the world is using as a standard, and you will see it throughout the IPCC. One of the clear things to recognize is that they're labeled high, medium, and low, not because they're the highest or not because they're the lowest. They are just relative to each other, and it's distinct language that is used in the UK CPO9. It's often said that, and you heard it in the introduction, that we're following, some people believe that we're following right at this particular time, a medium emission scenario. What we're actually doing is the medium emission scenario at this particular time, if you look at it, is the highest growing one, is the fastest growing emission scenario at this time. It's called medium because in 2100, it ends up at medium. It's not because it's medium all the way along. And we are following right now the highest of the ESRES scenarios, the IPCC scenarios at this particular time. And it's something to keep in your mind is that you have to explore the various sensitivity of your decision to the different emission scenarios and not just choose one because we're following it right now. You have to understand that sensitivity.
Was that okay? Okay, gentleman down here in the check shirt.
John Page, University of Sheffield. I've been associated with the climate change scenarios for quite a long time because I was on the original climate change impact review group and wrote the chapters on building in the first two versions. And of course, it's been very interesting to me to see the long history of evolution, and in particular to welcome the statistical approach that you find in the new document. I am currently struggling with quite a difficult task, which is revising a book I wrote for WMO some 30 years ago on building climatology. And in my world of risk, I ask what bit of the risk problem has been clarified by the new report, and which bits seem still a bit up in the sky. And in my world, the sun really drives the process through radiation. And the long-wave radiation bands and the short-wave radiation bands are the drivers of the thermal performance of buildings. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we don't have a lot of information. I think there was an odd whisper about a bit of sunshine somewhere in the report. I have quite a lot of my own software, which I'm developing in relation to this. And I think there are opportunities to perhaps bring in some modelling of the radiation alongside the agricultural modelling. And I've worked with the group that produced the Meteonorm system in Switzerland, and I'm sure there is a kind of integration to be made there. One important point, which I think should be posted very high in the sky, is that the sun's motion will not change. And you often get people talking about the climate of Nice and so on and so forth, but we can reckon to have still a miserable altitude of sun at about 12 degrees in the middle of winter. And being as warm as Nice will still leave us with a very low sun. And a funny characteristic of the low sun in the winter is you have a very impactful sun in the summer. So high latitudes suffer much more in sunny weather than low latitudes, simply because of the geometry of the problem. So there is a kind of very central geometric question that sort of links on to all of this, which I'm not saying it should have been the document, but I think we could add to the document, is my observation. There's one final point I have, which is about risk and wind, which of course is a major problem, and I've written a chapter about risk and wind for the book I'm preparing. And the general conclusion we reached, looking at the data in WMO, was that we couldn't say whether the wind risk was going to increase or not. There's a huge amount of passion around in the world that the wind's going to get stronger and stronger and the hurricanes are going to blow harder and harder. But when you look objectively at the WMO evidence, we could not find a basis for making projections about the future wind. And I think it was interesting that the report was quite silent about wind. And I think that's something we should take note of, because wind is such an important risk factor. But I would congratulate the team that produced this new report, and particularly all the work they've done on producing user-friendly systems for using it, because in the end, the value of the work lies in the users using it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Yes, that's very true. And I hope that we've started to demonstrate at least today that we're here to support you as users or as potential users in using the system. I know Chris has got a comment. So,
John, thank you very much for that. I know you're interested in radiation, and it's one of the things, like wind, where we think there's an extra that we can bring in other expertise, other models, to give people as much as we can for that subject. So the wind, if we use the standard meteorological methods, it doesn't work very well, but there's other ways around it. And we want to explore wind, and radiation is certainly another one. And I do take your point about not using geographical analogues too much. Thank you.
Thank you. My name's Jacinta Thorley. I'm not either a scientist, a statistician, or a meteorologist, and I find myself very slightly intimidated. But having said that, what I do is work for a community development charity, and we support communities to take action on climate change, mitigation and adaption. And I'm kind of interested to know really where our communities would be interested, is on the impacts at the local level on their community. And I guess my question is this really directed at professionals and practitioners, or could we, with some training, use it probably at that more superficial level with the layman, or is a little knowledge a dangerous thing and should we keep away from it?
All right, I think you're working in a fascinating area where the balance is completely shifted. It's not about the physical properties of the climate, it's about the human response two things. So that's, if you like, the end of the spectrum for which we designed those key messages, the headlines, where we can express in just words what changes we anticipate. And it does put a huge burden on you to think, what does that mean for us, for the people we're looking after? If you like, it's a much more complex problem than agriculture and forestry, where actually they know a huge amount about how that system behaves under different climate conditions. And we don't know the same thing for vulnerable people, communities, how communities work. But that's what I'd say, is focus on those headline messages and ask yourselves, what does this mean? And you don't need to go into the detail.
We're working with a number of local authorities, one, you know, not just Oxfordshire, but other ones, you know, around the country. And what we find is that in discussing this with them, what we try to do is to take the key findings and the information we have and explore with them what this means for them so that they can develop headline, what we call headline messages. What does this mean for your particular community and the communities you're working with? And we're at the early stages, and we're having some success and some not as good success. And we'll have that until we learn. And I go through, even in the couple weeks since it's been out, I've gone through various phases with different groups and said, well, it's not working. I'll have to think of something, another way of doing it. But we're exploring it together. But I think the scientific community will have fun with this. I think it's fascinating as a scientist to actually look at what we could do with this. But I think the real value will come in when we actually see it being used by practitioners, those that are making decisions in the field. You know, that's where I see it. You know, I think it's going to be more exciting than what happens there. So we're hopeful, and we'll work with them.
If I could just add something as training officer for UKSIT, if a member of your groups kind of felt that they'd like to explore it, have a look at the e-learning, see how they get on with that, and if they feel that there's a need, by all means register and come on as part of the PIP program. The program is not exclusive. It's open to everybody who has an interest. But as Chris and Roger have said, you know, use it, use the projections at a level that's appropriate for you.
I was just going to say, the users panel had people from local authorities on it. So we're trying to capture it. Yeah, it could be lower. It was a planning officer.
Sorry. Stop digging now, Roger.
Thank you. Okay, the next question, lady in the middle.
Okay, Liz Crosby, Strategic Environmental. We work with decision makers, both at the policy and at a corporate level. And I applaud the range of probabilities, because that's extremely useful when you're trying to talk to non-scientific audiences about this information. A couple of very practical things. Could we have Google Map overlays? Because often we're using multiple information sources, and climate is just one small element in that. The other is, it would be really helpful on a policy and a commercial level to be able to know the state of information globally. We do a lot of work on sustainable commodities and sustainable agriculture questions, and the relationship between the UK and the rest of the world is critically important in those discussions. And it's very difficult as non-technical people to know how robust or otherwise the sources are. So it would be great if you could be a repository of that information and have some fairly big where to go signs. It would also be extremely useful to understand, again, in an extremely non-technical way, the level of discussion in terms of where the information is likely to, when it's likely to arrive. If you're looking at trying to put in terms of planning within even multinational companies, you know, think oil tankers, think how long they turn to go around. We need to know when information is going to be available, which will influence decisions. And even if the information is, from your point of view, extremely flaky, flaky is better than nothing. Which is, if you're talking about, you know, what are the implications for climate change on commodities which are monocultures in Southeast Asia, for example, knowing whether they can grow palm oil, which, you know, two major economies are based on, is kind of useful. So that there's what is scientifically comfortable and what is politically and commercially comfortable, and they're very different.
Okay, I think there were the three elements to that. The first one was Google Map overlays. The second one was what's the state of information globally, and how does it really compare with what we've got here in the UK? And was it flaky is better than nothing?
So, discuss.
Shall we start with the Google Map overlay?
Who knows about that?
Yeah, we had a lot of discussions about Google Map overlays and what we could do. And my recollection, Anna, was that we decided we couldn't do that for some licensing of problems or something like that. Or it's something we're thinking about, but it's something we couldn't do at this particular time. We're very pleased that we have it up and operating. And it's to do that. So I understand that. The state of information globally, a lot of countries are actually watching us to see what's going to happen. A lot of people have actually, some people are questioning what we've done and think it's the wrong way to go. Other people are very, very much watching us and seeing what's going to happen. There is some discussions of globalizing this type of approach. I don't know how far it's going to get or anything like that. And useful to understand level, when is new information likely to come? One of the interesting things is that you talked about this, and I'm going to link it with a couple of other things. Within the, with the Climate Change Act, there's now a requirement that beginning now, is that the UK government put together a national assessment of the risks that are occurring, risks associated with climate change, and what is going to be done in this country. And one of the elements, the first one has to be completed by, I think it has to go before Parliament at the latter part of 2011, or is it early 2012?
2011.
And then every 5 years after that. And one of the points that came up is that this global aspect, I mean, we are not, even though we are an island, we're not an island unto ourselves, and we are very much affected by it. So they're going to be looking at how best to bring that information in, and I think we will learn a lot with this first assessment, which has to be actually finished by April 2011. So we'll learn a lot about how that will happen. Some of you are probably involved in that exercise. It's out there right now. It's about to start.
Chris, what's about the notion of UKCIT becoming a repository of information?
Well, it's something we want to do, and we're aware of other data sources for different parts of the world. If you're interested in Central America, for example, there is a Google Earth-based climate information database. The World Bank has one that works for Africa. And there are others. And we can point some of those at you. The problem is that we go a lot closer than anyone else in saying how flaky our information is. We don't think it's very flaky, but we recognize it's a bit. Nobody else on the planet will admit there's a slightest degree of flakiness. But one of the things that's an advantage here in the UK, we have an extraordinarily good description of the past climate, so that we can actually have a 5 kilometre observed climate. Many parts of the world, they don't have a clue what the climate has been, what the climate is now. And so a climate change information is almost valueless. So the message, I think, is you should be deeply suspicious of anyone who tells you about the future. You should ask questions like, says who? You know, demonstrate your process, and you have to be quite sceptical about climate information because it's pure speculation. Sorry, could we have the recording turned off? Pure speculation. We do our best, but you have to be a suspicious customer.
I think the other thing, just to talk briefly about Google overlays, is that at the moment it's not something that we can do, but you can extract the map data and import it into a GIS system, and there's various formats in which you can do that. So I don't know if that's any help to you. It's probably not if you're looking at a global scale, but certainly if you're looking at it, you know, locally, and you've got other systems that you want and other map layers that you already have access to, then you can add the UK CPO9 data as another layer on a GIS system. So I hope that kind of helps that as well.
Yeah.
Do you want, Diana, can you just give...
I'll clarify that. That is planned that we have GIS and be able to extract it. It's not quite there yet, and there's a discussion going on.
And if anyone's really interested, I'll explain it to you another time, but it's not quite available.
So sorry, I've jumped the gun. It's coming, and watch this space. Okay, who's another question?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Hi. David Nichols from Arriva Risk Management Consulting. If I understand correctly, this is a question about scenarios. If I understand correctly, all your projections are for either the high, medium, or low emission scenarios. And I understand you don't try and combine uncertainty about which scenario might occur with the uncertainty in the actual climate projections, which I fully understand. But I wonder, is there any guidance on how the variation between scenarios compares against the uncertainty within scenarios? I'd expect that some parameters will be more sensitive to emissions than others. So is there any way, for example, that you can save the user having to look at all three scenarios for all the parameters?
All right, I'll start answering that question. I hope Roger will take over when I start foundering. At the moment, it's not possible to ascribe probabilities to those emission scenarios. So effectively, we're saying we don't know which one we're going to follow, or if we'll follow any of them. So the trick is to look at least the three we present. Up to about mid-century, you may well find that the change is much the same for each of those scenarios, and they start to diverge the second half of the century. So for the different climate variables, we think they will all diverge at much the same rate. There isn't one obvious climate variable that's more or less sensitive to the emission scenarios. So that's one thing. It's a non-trivial but possible task to add other scenarios, and that may be one of the extras we feed in to include some sort of mitigation scenario, should we ever get onto one. So that's part of the answer. Roger, can you help now?
No, I don't think there's much more I can add. It'd be very interesting to look at. We haven't gone in, and nor has am I aware that the Met Office has gone in and looked at the relative difference that occurs from variable to variable as a result of the different emission scenarios. It's something you could explore very easily, because you could actually put emission scenarios and all three emission scenarios on one graph and look at how it behaves as you go across those, and you can look at the differences that occur. But I'm unaware of anyone that's done it. There could have been, and I just haven't seen it.
Okay, that's a difficult and challenging question. So thank you very much. The gentleman here, Chris.
Peter Taylor. I'm an ecologist with an interest in kind of landscape scale conservation strategies, particularly in the Lake District. And I've been very concerned about the fact that mitigation strategies are very unlikely to affect what's going to happen in the next 20 or 30 years. And therefore, I've been trying to urge more of an adaptation strategy than a mitigation one. And in the last two or three years, I've been looking at the flakiness of the climate models, particularly the IPCC last report. And I've actually just spent 2 years producing a critique of those models. And I'm very aware that the UK sits right next to a heat store in the Atlantic Ocean that's been building up over the last 25 or 30 years, a similar heat store built up in the North Pacific. And you could say that about 80% of global warming in terms of heat rather than surface temperature is located in those two gyres. Very little heat stored in the southern hemisphere. The Pacific heat store virtually disappeared in the northwest Pacific within 2 years as the Pacific decadal oscillation turned, and 30 years of global warming in Alaska was overturned within 2 years. The Atlantic has a similar multi-decadal oscillation, and I was talking with Hadley last week and saying, are the current projections, do they incorporate such oscillations? Because obviously, if the same thing happened to the Atlantic as has happened to the Pacific, then we could be faced with distinct cooling over the next decade. And given the last winter particularly, and the last two summers of torrential rain, and the shifting of the jet stream, These are very important immediate concerns for land use managers. There are signs that the Atlantic is turning, but what I was told is that there is a team working on medium-term projections, and that they're trying to build into the models, which so far don't incorporate natural cycles because they're not well enough understood, but that the long-range projections don't include natural cycles. And there is a school of thought that with the current solar minimum, we may be facing a return to the Maunder minimum and a potential little ice age. Yep. So I'm concerned, given that it's very hard to have much faith in this type of probabilistic assessment. The probabilities depend entirely on how reliable the models are. And I'd just like your comment on that. Thank you.
Okay, it's a very valid point that what we're talking about is very much long-term change. And although those long-term changes will be an average, if you like, there will be superimposed on that shorter cycles. Now, the models reproduce those cycles quite well in a general statistical way. So they replicate the ENSO, the Atlantic Oscillation. What they don't do is tie them to the phase we're in at the moment. So over the 10 years from now onwards, they're quite good, and that oscillation is included in the variability. Over the next decade, they are very poor at incorporating each cycle as it is at the moment. And it's one of our ambitions eventually, and I think UKCP next, to bring together that long-term modelling of underlying trends, the observations bang up to date, and that difficult period, the next decade, where we're beginning to be able to forecast it, but it's actually much more difficult than the day-to-day forecasting, and it's very much more difficult than the long-term climate trends. So it's a useful point, and we're not entirely there yet. I think the underlying trends are still useful, even if we have some uncertainty over the next few years.
Roger.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that when you're looking at climate change, I can find any trend you want to find by looking at very limited portions of the curve. There is any trend. I mean, I can go back into the 1970s in this country, and I can find a very benign trend. I can go back, and that's at a UK scale. We can find the cooling trend that occurred after the 1940s. We can find the extreme trends that are like this. So you can find different things. And that's why we always look at the longer-term trend. And you have to look at that longer-term trend. What's happening now, both in the Pacific and some people are concerned it's happening in the Atlantic, is that it's two things if you look at it, what's happened over the last 10 to 15 years. And that's, again, looking at a very limited thing. And that is that what we had up until about a year ago was we had an NAO phase, a North Atlantic Oscillation phase, that was positive or was creating positive feedback with the climate signal. What is happening now is that you're getting that shift, and we're getting a one that is fighting it, so it's off going against it. And this is the same thing that's what's happening in the Pacific. You get a negative trend. And that will decrease the amount of heating or warming that we will see. And what you will see is that you will see this slightly cooling trend that occurs when it shifts back, as it will do. Then that's the concern that a lot of people have, is that it comes back in phase with the climate change signal, and it'll augment even further the climate change that we will see in consistent with the enhanced warming. So it's looking at the feedback between the two systems that you have to look at. You cannot just look at one little bit of a trend, but also look at the larger scale. The warming that has occurred in the oceans is down to 3,000 meters. You can get cooling that occurs in that top layer. To get the cooling to actually go down to that 3,000 meters is going to take a number of years. The heat storage that is in the ocean is quite significant. And the belief is with the heat storage that we now have in there, the sea level rise is with us for at least, I think the number I've seen is in the 700 to 1500 years, just because of the heat that's already in there. And we'll realize that heat as it comes up. So you know, a little bit of a turnover for a short period of time as a result of a switch of an oscillation, it will have a regional impact on climate. It will not have a global impact. It will not have that global impact. And that's the difference we have between what we had in the past is we've had these regional changes. We haven't had this global change. And so when all the oceans are warming up, we're now seeing the new information that's coming out is that the Antarctic is warming. It's not cooling as a lot of people thought it was because we've now got better data that's looking at that. We've got better data that's come out since the IPCC that is suggesting that we have to be taking these things into consideration, as you point out, the oscillations. But they're not overriding, they're just changing the variability that we're going to see as we go throughout the overall trend as over a period of time. And that's what these projections are looking at. It's over time. And the variability still has to be dealt with.
Okay. There's
a bunch of questions up here. And
okay, we are virtually out of time, so if you could keep it brief. If you just kind of quick punchy questions and we'll get through as many as we can.
It's a very brief question about what data is available. It may have been answered in the first question, but I wasn't entirely sure. Is the raw data from sort of the different ensembles and different models that was used to construct the probabilities available or not, probability distributions?
The values from the ensembles, the regional climate model is available through another website that I'll talk to you about privately, but it is available. The actual runs of the GCM, et cetera, are not available. It's only the projections as a result. When the projections are put forward, there is actually a million different variants, and it's brought down to 10,000 just because it's unmanageable. You may be able to, if you work with the Met Office, you may be able to get some of the other runs, but I doubt it.
Okay, thank you, Roger. Another quick one.
I hope that's not stupid or rude. I read that this report is not peer-reviewed as such. So my question is, how far can you say it reflects some scientific consensus at the moment, or could somebody else come up with very different conclusions with a different model?
I think I'll let Chris answer that one.
Okay, you're quite right that this whole process has not been peer-reviewed in the way that publications would be. It will be because the scientists who generated the information and the methodology are, as we speak, writing those papers, which will be peer-reviewed. What we did was submit the process in January to an international review panel convened by DEFRA's chief scientist, chaired by Brian Hoskins. And they submitted a report back to DEFRA saying what they thought about the methodology. My summary of their summary is the methodology is valid, but a lot depends on the guidance that's given with the information. And we've addressed that. We've addressed most of the points they raised. One or two points we said we actually disagree and we didn't address them. But the overriding message to me was this methodology is valid and you need to write a very good set of guidance. And I think we've done that.
The actual various elements of the projections have been peer-reviewed and they're based on peer review. It's just the final compilation of putting it all together. But it has undergone a fair amount, I'd say a considerable amount of scrutiny, and the peer review, full peer review, will only add value to it and credibility.
Okay, well, on that positive note, I'd like to say thank you to all of you for coming. Thank you to Roger and Chris for answering all those questions. And thank you to everyone who's spoken and all my UKCIP colleagues for helping out and making this event go so smoothly. So thank you very much and a big round of applause for everybody.